Oh, hey, you're here. Listen, come on in, make yourself comfortable. I'm just picking out some tunes here. What do you think about this one? From WUOT News, this is a special holiday edition of The Method. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. We've got some hot cocoa and cookies here on the coffee table, seasonally appropriate music, and a look back at the best stories and interviews we've featured over the past year. So pull up a chair, make yourself at home. Joining me here in front of the crackling fire is Chrissy Kuiper. You told me a little bit about some of your favorite interviews from the past year, one of which came from our very first edition back in May. That's when you talked with Gary McCracken about white nose syndrome. So tell us a little bit about that interview and why you liked it.
He is a bat expert, and he has been following the epidemic of white nose syndrome, which is spreading across North America. And so we got together and talked about sort of the latest news on this syndrome, which is killing millions of bats, not only in North America now, but in Europe as well.
So what we have is a disease that started at a point source that is rapidly spread across at least the eastern half of North America. And our project is basically to look at the epidemiology of this disease, to plot its spread across the continent, and hopefully to discover solutions to quell the spread of the fungus. We can go in and we can swab the bats with cotton swabs, and then from that swab, isolate the DNA of the fungus. So we can actually identify the presence of the fungus on the bats without having to visually see the white nose, so to speak. The real damage is actually caused by the growth of the fungus into the tissue of the bats, particularly the wing tissue.
And then just a few months later, in July, you talked with another UT professor. This was Jan Schimmick, and you guys talked about some prehistoric art found in caves. So tell us a little about why that was such a memorable interview for you.
He has been working on southeastern cave art for much of his career, and this is some of the oldest art in general in North America. It's some of the oldest art in North America, and it is a lot of it is found in the southeast, particularly in Tennessee. Much of it along the Cumberland Plateau, but then some here in East Tennessee as well.
We have a couple of sites that have very early dates for cave art in the dark zone of caves. We make a distinction between artwork that actually is exposed to exterior light and artwork that's deep underground. And in Tennessee, some of the art is over a mile underground. The reason we make that distinction is it becomes a technical problem to go to these places where they're decorating it, and they have to provision themselves with light. It's not a place where people live. It's a place that they intentionally go, so it's almost an act of pilgrimage at the outset to go to these places. The earliest example of that we have is a cave that's actually not very far from Knoxville that was discovered 4 or 5 years ago, in fact, and dated 4 or 5 years ago to something over 6,000 years ago. Mm. That's quite early. It probably is the oldest cave art that we know of in North America. It's not the oldest rock art. We're claiming the oldest cave art. One of the reasons that's probably true that it's in Tennessee is we also have, you know, the vast majority of the cave art in North America. Here, we now know it was a tradition. We now have 70 caves that have artwork here in Tennessee, North Alabama, North Georgia, concentrated in the southeast. And that's far and away the largest scale evidence for this practice of going deep underground and decorating caves anywhere in North America.
That sounds delightful. More eggnog, Chrissy?
Mmm, it does go well with the ice cream.
And science.
Well, Brandon, two of your interviews from the year were also people who work here at the University of Tennessee.
That's right. In May, I talked for our very first episode with historian Ernest Freeburg. And later on in the year, in September, I talked with planetary scientist Josh Emery. And those were two of my favorite interviews this year.
What did you talk to Freeburg about?
Well, back in May, I sat down with Ernie Freeburg to talk a little bit about Thomas Edison. And Edison is a guy about whom so many dozens and hundreds of books have been written. But the interesting thing about Freeburg's book, and the reason it ties back into science, is he was making the case that Edison didn't just invent the light bulb. He didn't just invent motion pictures or the phonograph. He actually invented a way of life, and we're still living in the America that Edison helped create.
Above all else, we live in an age where we assume that technological invention is just a feature of our daily life, that we assume that great new inventions are coming along. We don't know necessarily what they are, but we know they're going to come. You know, and Edison and his cohort in the 19th century really created that new relationship to technology, led many Americans to start to think of themselves as a nation of creators, technological creators.
You spoke to planetary scientist Josh Emery as well. He is known for his work on asteroids. Mm-hmm. What did you speak to him about?
Well, believe it or not, that's what we talked about, asteroids.
Oh, okay.
And in fact, we talked about something that isn't quite as it seems. And so sometimes with a dead comet that doesn't produce a tail anymore, it doesn't have gaseous outbursts anymore like an active comet, it can kind of go cold and dark, and scientists can often mistake it for an asteroid. And it's only until you do some very detailed research you can actually tell the difference. And so a team that Josh Emery was working with actually found that out, that something that was thought to be a cold, dead asteroid for many years actually turns out to be a dormant comet.
Most near-Earth asteroids really are rocky bodies. They come from the main asteroid belt, but astronomers have been thinking for a while that as comets come close to the sun, they lose some ices, and they go far away, and they come close again, lose some ices, that eventually they'll be depleted of their ices. And one big question with respect to near-Earth asteroids is how many of them are rocky bodies versus how many are these extinct comets or dead comets. And that's of interest to us, especially when we start thinking about near-Earth asteroids as potential hazards to the Earth, and what their effect might be when they hit the Earth, and how we might protect the Earth, change the orbit of an object. All of these issues depend on what the internal strength of the body is like, and so depend on knowing whether it's rocky or fluffy like a comet.
And look who's joined us on the couch, Christine Jessel. Christine, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Merry Christmas.
And to you as well. Your favorite story from the past year was actually a very memorable one that you did for our October edition about the science of moonshine. What was so interesting about that story?
I really enjoyed that story because I got to go up to an actual distillery and sort of see how the process worked. But then I also got a scientist to explain to me, hey, what exactly is happening in these giant tubs?
And you also busted a myth about cars, too. They don't run on alcohol the way they've seen in movies.
They do not run on alcohol.
Not directly. If you put hooch in your gas tank, you will have a problem.
Okay, so no Thunder Road with moonshine in the back.
A bottle of whiskey is not going to do you.
Well, that was fun, and it was good seeing you guys. But you know what? I've got another party to get to. So Merry Christmas, and I'll see you all later.
Well, Christine, thanks so much for coming in.
Happy holidays from The Method.
Thank you very much, Chrissy, for coming in. And I'll extend those holiday wishes to all of you as well, and best wishes for 2014.